data scientists worry about companies are going to build AI data scientists to replace them. What's your take on that?
I'm proud to say I think we've built the best notebook, although we don't think of ourselves as just a notebook.
What are some tools you think that are emerging, and what are some tools you think are going away?
The biggest version of Hex is building this unified front end for the data stack. There's things that are going to do a pretty good job writing code. The question is, do you know which code to ask it to write?
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Data Scientist Show. Today, we have Barry Mercardell. He's the co-founder and CEO of Hex, a collaborative data workspace. Their customers include Fivetran, Notion, Anthropic, and Cetera. He used to build data products at Palantir, and he was a management consultant at PwC building data apps. He has used many data science tools before he started Hex. Today, we'll talk about Barry's stories of building data apps, how to tackle challenges of data team collaborations, how to prepare your data analysis for stakeholders, future of data science team, and how to leverage AI in data scientist workflow. If you enjoy the show, subscribe to the channel and give me a 5-star review. Welcome to the show, Barry.
Thanks for having me here.
So a lot of people are talking about the data analysis capacities from ChatGPT, and data scientists worry about companies are going to build AI data scientists to replace them. What's your take on that?
I am very skeptical that data professionals are going to be replaced by AI. At Hex, we've been doing a lot with AI. We were very early in introducing what I think are some pretty amazing AI features and generative AI features into Hex, but we always came at that with the belief of those features should be there to augment and accelerate human insight, not replace it.
Mm-hmm.
I actually believe that data work is sort of a very creative endeavor and a really good use of human time and intuition. If you think about what like a really great data scientist or data analyst does, they are deeply understanding a problem or a question in the organization. They are going and thinking critically about how to gather data, and they have a deep understanding of what the data represents. They're iterating and exploring, forming hypotheses, digging deeper. They're driving the answers, and they're sharing and communicating that in a way that can help drive a decision. And I think people look at generative AI and they see its ability to like write code. And I think especially people who aren't haven't done this professionally.
Yeah.
Look at that and they're like, well, data scientists and data analysts just write code. And great, this thing can write code. So like that'll just replace them. And mm-hmm. I think it's a very one-dimensional view of what these people do. And it is true that these AI features can accelerate things. It is true that it can get rid of a lot of the mundane and tedious work. It is true that there are certain types of things that data scientists and data analysts and data engineers spend their day on that will either go away or be much simpler. But I am actually really bullish that this is going to be like a new golden age for data professionals and data teams, not the beginning of the end.
Yeah. And I also have a friend told me he can put like a spreadsheet into ChatGPT, and then it can give him a model that ranks, say, 70% at Kaggle. But my question is, how comfortable are you interpreting the results to your stakeholders or put a model in production?
Well, and that's a great example, because I think from the outside, it's like the daily work of a data scientist isn't like stuff that would like rank on Kaggle.
Yeah.
You could have a bot that would score 100% on Kaggle and still not actually be that useful in a business context.
Yeah.
No disrespect to Kaggle. Kaggle is really cool. But I think, again, it's sort of a one-dimensional and slightly flawed view of this. And I think, so I have a fundamental belief that there's sort of a boundless demand for insight in organizations. Like, I think we have the number of data scientists and data analysts and whatever we have, not because it's like a perfect match of supply and demand where it's, okay, the business has this many questions and that can be satisfied by this many data scientists who can answer some number of questions per day. So that's like the function.
Mm.
No, it's like a budgetary exercise. It's, well, this is how many people we can hire because that's what the CFO said we can do this year.
Yeah.
But I actually think there's millions of questions every day that people are asking or decisions they're making that could be better decisions or be better informed with data insight, but they're not, because like the data team is like hard to work with. It's like, I send them a question, I won't get anything back for a couple of weeks. They got a backlog. They're working on other stuff. They have to do a bunch of data munging before they're able to get to this question for me. And so it turns out like most decisions in most companies most days, including like just to be honest, like here at Hex, don't have data because it's just the cycles on insights are long. And I think the fundamental thing we're interested in as like a product at Hex, and we'll get more into that shortly. The AI stuff is just a continuation of it, is how do you tighten up those feedback loops? How do you tighten the loop and iteration loop between a question someone in the business has and being able to make a data-informed decision? And that is not like fundamentally an exercise in like scoring on Kaggle.
Yeah.
Like there's a million other parts of that, of which like writing correct code or like a certain type of whatever, like machine learning function may be one part of it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that boundless demand is about, we're going to be building tools, including a lot of things that AI is going to have a deep impact on, that will better be able to keep up with that demand. And I actually think that we will see a proliferation of data roles, not a diminution of them. I have a kind of counterintuitive, somewhat contrarian take on this, which I actually think we may have more data scientists and more data analysts in a few years than less.
I think previously, a lot of small companies, they can't afford a data team. So instead of having, say, 20 data scientists in one team, maybe in larger organizations, they can have those AI tools to enable data scientists. The team size might be smaller, but then there might be more data scientists work for smaller companies or say one person data science team.
Yeah. Maybe. Another way to get at what I'm saying is, let's say you have that 20 person data science team and you go, well, these AI tools can make them twice as efficient. Well, that means we only need 10 data scientists, right? Great. Let's fire half the data scientists. Mm-hmm. Let's buy them this AI data scientist tool and we're on our way. I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding because I don't think that the demand is capped. I don't think those 20 people, I don't think that there's like a fixed number. Like you could answer the same number of questions with 10 people and then 10 people. What I think is going to happen is you could have those same 20 data scientists and they're going to be twice as productive. There's a million more questions that they could be helping inform and a lot more impact data teams can be having. I think we're actually just scratching the surface of the impact that data teams can have in organizations. And so I don't think it will be, oh, the team sizes are going to shrink. I think it's going to be, these teams feel way more impactful. That's exciting. And I actually think that's going to uncork a lot of demand for more, not less. And it is true, by the way, that you can look at this and be like, maybe someone who doesn't have a technical background can look at this and say, well, yesterday I couldn't write Python. Today, ChatGPT can write Python or Hex can write Python for me.
Yeah.
So now I can write Python. Now I don't need these data scientists. But I don't think that adds up to you don't need that. I don't think that works. I don't think what the data scientists are doing is just writing Python.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of other things going into it. And the idea that these tools mean you don't need these data professionals, I think is very simplistic and one-dimensional.
Yeah. When I was working at Amazon, there's our endless backlog of things we want to do for data science team. There's always more questions from stakeholders. And imagine,
of course. What data team doesn't have that? So again, let's imagine you had a tool that made you twice as effective. Does that mean that you fire half the team and the backlog stays the same? Or does that mean, hey, we're able to get through a bunch more of these?
Yeah, exactly.
By the way, I also think, so there's this phenomenon called induced demand, which is like a weird phenomenon is when they expand inner freeways, highways, and build more lanes because traffic is bad. Often the traffic is just as bad. Mm. And it's like, why would it be just as bad? We built more lanes.
Yeah.
Well, you built more lanes, which means more people are like, oh, I can get from A to B. Or, and the traffic kind of fills the available space. And I think that's going to be a very similar thing with data teams where you're going to have data scientists will basically have more lanes. They're going to have more bandwidth because a lot of the stuff you spend your day doing can be simplified and accelerated. But I don't think that means there's like less cars on the road. I think there's like more cars on the road because there's more lanes.
Yeah.
That is exciting to me. That is a reason I think for a lot of optimism and excitement of data professionals, not existential dread.
Right. And imagine, say, 20 years ago, people are hand coding a regression algorithm. And just because we have Python packages to help us with machine learning algorithm doesn't mean we have fewer data scientists.
Did all the data scientists go away? No, there's way more of them.
Yeah. Because it's easier to use. You can drive more insights. When you have insights, you always have more questions.
Totally. Boundless demand.
Yeah.
Boundless demand.
So data scientists already have a lot of tools. I'm curious what kind of horror stories you have experienced with other data tools that inspire you to create a tool for yourself.
Yeah. I can say a brief bit about like what Hex is,
sure.
And then I can talk about mm-hmm. why we built it. So Hex is a collaborative workspace for data science and analytics. And what that basically means is it's a low floor, high ceiling tool. So it's available to people from a variety of technicality levels. And it really lets you go end to end in your data workflows, from a quick maybe SQL query and a chart you just want to build, like a just quick question, all the way through a deep dive model that might mix SQL, Python, no code together, to a published interactive data app. It could be something simple like a report, or it could be something really complex, like sort of a fully interactive data experience with inputs and outputs and write backs to databases. Mm-hmm. But you can do that all in one platform. And that stands in contrast to a lot of the very fragmented, what I think is very broken and non-collaborative workflows that exist out in the world. And I had certainly suffered through a lot of these in my career, where I'd been on data teams, or I'd been doing data type tasks or working with data teams where we were doing great work. Or I've seen a lot of data teams where they're doing great work, but they're really held back by, as an individual, like I've got these very fragmented tools, like I'm writing a SQL query over here, I'm pulling it down to a CSV here, I'm uploading it into a Jupyter notebook here, I'm getting to my result, I'm screenshotting a chart. Now I want to collaborate with someone on it. Okay, I've got to take this Python notebook and check it into GitHub, and like the collaboration on this stuff just has always sucked. And then I want to share my results with a stakeholder. Okay, now I've got to take a screenshot of a chart and put it in a PDF of a deck I'm sending in an email.
Yeah.
And then that stakeholder comes back and they're like, oh, this is nice, but what if we assumed 3 instead of 4? You got to go back and try to pull off that same magic trick again.
Yeah.
And I had just felt that pain all through my career. So as you had mentioned earlier, I started my career in consulting outside of college. I think I was interested in out of college. And I was always the person on my projects. My consulting projects like wanted to do the like hardcore Excel stuff. I was like really into data stuff in undergrad. So I'd build these really complex, basically data apps in Excel with Access databases. And I was like publishing version 14.3 of my model with all these inputs and outputs. And this is the tab you upload the CSV in, and these 5 tabs process the data. And then here's the outputs. And it was like really complex. And I didn't really know better at the time. Like I had written some R, and then a friend of mine was like, hey, you should come to Palantir. Like we could do this for real. And so I had a wonderful almost 5 years at Palantir building, getting to use and then participate in building a variety of really interesting data products for a lot of different types of problems and solutions all over the world. And then I left there to go to a healthcare startup where we kind of had this problem. I was like, it was interesting coming out of Palantir, which was kind of our own bubble where we built all of our own stuff, to this healthcare startup where we had like a modern data stack. We had like a cloud data warehouse. We were really early DBT adoptees. We had a BI tool, but still our data team was sort of like operating in this very fragmented space. And as someone at that point in my career who was more of a stakeholder, I was sort of on the receiving end of a lot of this pain, where I would go to them with a question and it would be like, we'll get back to you in a couple of weeks when we can recreate this alchemy we did with this thing. I was like, why should it be that way? And so I actually started this journey as a buyer. Like I was kind of looking for Hex. I was hoping someone had built Hex. I was out talking to other data teams being like, hey, what are you all doing to solve this? And people would point me at things, products that existed. I would try them. I was like, this isn't very good.
Yeah.
People would be like, well, there's this Jupyter open source thing. If you get these 8 different open source packages and you get all the versions right, and you host them yourself, and you have someone basically supporting it full time, and if Mercury and Venus are aligned in the sky, this will solve your problem. And it just was an awful experience.
Yeah.
And so at some point I transitioned from kind of being like a prospective buyer to a builder. There was a day where I was maybe we should do this. Because I'd worked with some really phenomenal people at Palantir, and we had some experience building great data products. And so one thing led to another, and now here we are. So yeah, that's the journey.
Yeah. So can you tell us more about what project or what kind of tools you use when you were a management consultant?
Well, when I was in consulting, so this was the early 2010s, it was Excel, and Excel still kind of rules the world in many ways. And yeah, I was building these really complex Excel models with macros, and I've learned about like Access. For those of you who don't know, Microsoft Access, shout out to Microsoft Access. It's basically this like database, kind of, you can host your own little database mm-hmm. that has a nice interface through Excel. And so I like the statute of limitations is probably expired on this, but I basically stole a PC tower, not stole, I borrowed a PC tower at my client, was working at an airline at the time, and plugged it in under the desk to host this Access database because it wouldn't fit on my laptop with all this data about a bunch of aircraft stuff I was working on at the time. And I was really proud of this. It was cool. It was like I was nerding out. I was building these really complex systems, basically in Excel and Access. And I didn't really have an awareness of a broader set of data tools. And then I went to Palantir and sort of mid 2010s when there was this sort of renaissance. And that was when big data became a thing. That was when data science became a thing. I was using a lot of Python notebooks. Back in the day, they were just called IPython notebooks before the project became Jupyter, and got really deep into that. I was doing a lot in SQL and Python. And at Palantir, we obviously built a lot of our own data tools. But even there, especially in the early days of our sort of commercial side, we didn't have a lot of stuff. And so I was cobbling together a lot of workflows myself in the same way. And so I'd been using Jupyter notebooks for a very long time. And Hex, you can kind of look at it some people think of us as a notebook product. In fact, I'm proud to say I think we've built the best notebook out there, although we don't think of ourselves as just a notebook. I do think that interface has a lot to recommend it and a lot of legs. And I always felt like it had way more potential than was being realized. And so that was part of the sort of many years of using these types of tools that sort of fed into some of the intuitions that led to Hex.
When I created a Hex account and play with it, I noticed, I think it definitely have some inspiration from like Excel spreadsheet, some functionality there, but you also have different cells. People can write SQL and Python together. And instead of remembering all the matplotlib syntax, you can easily create a visualization. Yeah, it seems like all the frustrations in the past kind of like
it's a product of pain. Totally. I mean, Jupyter and the IPython world, these are great projects. Like I didn't build Hex to be like a Jupyter killer. I have a ton of respect for them and a lot of gratitude because I used those products for a long time. I think we're trying to accomplish something kind of different at Hex and maybe take some of those ideas much further than those projects could go. But yeah, you're right. So one of the things we did was we built this sort of fully polyglot environment in Hex where I can go back and forth between SQL, Python, and no code in any combination. And we talk about the kind of like tau of Hex, the kind of some of the fundamental physics of the way the product works. And one of them is embracing that cell architecture of notebooks. So in IPython or Jupyter, there's only two cell types. There's Python and Markdown.
Yeah.
And we kind of were like, well, what if there was a lot of cell types? Mm-hmm. And so we have SQL, we have charts, we have pivots, we have tables, we have a wide variety of input parameters, we have write back cells.
Yeah.
We've got this sort of richer thing that we kind of see the cell as this fundamental like atomic unit. And you can even kind of build your own cells now with our components feature. There's sort of this fundamental thing where we're like, we think this format, the notebook format had always been locked up behind being a very technical thing. IPython and Jupyter were a very technical thing. Like step one was like learn computers. It was like, you have to be able to install a local Python environment and like you're in the terminal and you're like installing Jupyter and like, am I installing Jupyter Core, Jupyter Notebook or Jupyter Lab?
Right.
And then you're like running these things and they're really only accessible to people who would have otherwise been doing like local software development, which is, that's not impossible when I learned it. I think the notebook format actually in some ways is even most profound and most powerful for people outside that. And what a really interesting thing is when we talk to users and customers, as far as we can tell, it's hard to know for sure, the majority of our users were not using Jupyter previously. They're not like, oh, I use Hex instead of Jupyter, which I was using. I actually talked to a user one time and I was like, oh, we're using notebooks before. And they're like, what's a notebook? I was like, whoa, that's really interesting that they're using Hex. To them, that's just how Hex works.
Yeah.
They're not like, this is a better Jupyter. They're like, this is just a great way to work. And they're not writing a single line of Python. They're just writing SQL and using our no-code cells. So I think that's evidence that there's a lot more potential to this, to some of these tools than was being realized in the past.
Yeah, and I remember when I was working with SQL, there's no way I can share like a query in an interactive way with my stakeholders. I would copy paste and maybe kind of like you mentioned, screenshot some results and then hey, by the way, if you want to play with it yourself, here are like instructions of how to get access. Yeah, yeah. And stakeholders are busy. They don't have time to get access and play with your analysis. Yeah. I also had a big attachment of all my outputs in Excel, but you know, they're not opening it.
Naturally. So yeah, so in Hex, you could either share them on the notebook that has the SQL in it, or it's very easy to add input parameters. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of wire a UI in and publish an app. So they don't even have to see the SQL, right? They can see some dropdowns, the outputs. Mm-hmm. You kind of parameterize it for them. And they could take that, they can branch it off themselves. You could make it more complex. You can publish new versions over time. We think it's a much better way to work. Because I had the same experience. A lot of people have the same experience. Probably millions of people have felt that pain. And I think for whatever reason, we just kind of looked at that and we're like, well, why hasn't no one done a better job on this? And hopefully people find Hex to be an expression of a better way to work.
Yeah. So in general, when you present your data analysis to stakeholders, what are some best practices?
I think there's a problem sometimes in the data space of treating our stakeholders like they're like children. And look, I've been there. I get it. It's easy to be like, well, they don't pay attention to anything. But I think we should treat stakeholders like they're really smart. And I think in some ways, Hex was very flexible. And so you can build something very dumbed down, so to speak, in Hex, where you publish something with just a couple inputs and an output and give that to your stakeholders. But I also think one of the cool parts in Hex is it is a very accessible, it's hosted web-based tool where you can just invite a stakeholder into a notebook, into a project to come explore or at least view the logic themselves. And so I think a best practice is sometimes just like treating them. People will sometimes rise to the level you invite them to. And this isn't Hex specific. You could probably say this for how to present your work in a lot of different tools. But that's one thing I think a lot about. More maybe Hex-centrically, we've got some really cool features around publishing new versions and approvals. And we've got some really great features and some stuff coming soon around sort of governance in Hex workspaces to be able to. So one thing you see in Hex is a lot of people wind up using it. Like your data team adopts it, but then it kind of gets all over because there's a lot of people who want to be able to ask and answer questions about data. And that can stress out data leaders, especially because it's like, well, there's a lot of different people are building these different projects. And so one thing that we find is a best practice in Hex is using our features around metadata and organization to help make it really clear what is sort of canon, so to speak, what is an approved, governed, approved project that really should be relied on. I think we just released this feature. It's a small feature, but I think it's kind of neat, last month, called Auto Archive, which is like, if a project hasn't been edited in some period of time or it hasn't been viewed in some period of time, it just automatically gets archived in your workspace. So your workspace cleans itself. So it's always really clear what is a relevant analysis. Now, it's not getting deleted. Like, you can go search for it and find it if you're like, oh, what was that thing? But when you find it, it's not rerunnable. It's kind of under glass because this is a historical insight. This should not be relied on in the future. I think that feeds into a general workflow that we're really excited about, where data teams can sort of manage a life cycle of analysis versus just having a million dashboards floating around that no one really knows what's relevant or not.
Yeah, I think it's easy to create so many metrics to present. The key is to tell the story, to tell the stakeholder what are the metrics they should look at. So do you think when you present, you should just put all the context there, have all the data set in the attachment, share all the notebooks, or what kind of presentation style you think that's best for stakeholders to digest the information?
It depends. Like, a funny thing I realized over the last couple of years is I went from being like a data practitioner to I'm a stakeholder now. Yeah. Like, I'm a CEO of a company. Like, I don't get to write code as much as I did. I don't get to do my own data analysis as much as I used to. And it depends. It depends on the thing. There's times where I want to see all the detail.
Yeah.
There's times where I'm like, hey, I just want to see a few key metrics that I know we can trust. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that I have like a one size fits all answer for that. Hopefully with Hex, one of our goals is it's flexible and you can, depending on what makes sense for you and your team and your stakeholders and the project, like, you can have a lot of flexibility in choosing which path you want to go on that.
Yeah. So previously you talked about data scientists have frustrations installing those packages, set up local environments. I definitely have that pain. I think whenever I'm bored on a new team, engineer usually pair with me to set up my local environment. And sometimes you have to find which Python you had, yeah, which Python right. 3.
Yeah.
And
which,
there,
yeah, which Python 3? I've done that.
Yeah, exactly. And then some people say, oh, data scientists should be full stack. You should be able to set up your environment, put things in production. What do you think?
I think what people are probably really trying to say when they say full stack, and I think this maybe started or was certainly perpetuated at Stitch Fix.
Mm.
We've got some folks here from Stitch Fix. My wife actually works at Stitch Fix, so I've got a little perspective on this. I think what people really mean by that is not a real data scientist should be able to like develop locally. I find that to be like a technical, almost like gatekeepy type thing I don't really care for. I think what people are really saying, what I fully believe, is that data practitioners should be thinking about how their work makes it into prod, so to speak. And I think a bug with data teams in the past that I've seen and I've been part of, honestly, was this sort of ivory towerism, which is like, oh, we're like an R&D team. We're doing experiments. We're doing research. Look at this. The model converged on this sample data set. Like, great. And I used to interview data scientists at past job, and I would ask them a question about what's the project you've worked on that you're most proud of. And then I didn't mean it as a gotcha, but it would wind up being a gotcha for a lot of people where I'd say, great, like, how's it doing in prod?
Yeah.
And you'd get this like blank stare from some people, right? Being like, what do you mean? How's it doing in prod? I told you already, the model converged. Like the results, the experiment results were good. Yeah, but like, what was the business impact?
Mm.
How did that improve a decision? What system is running better because of this? And that was a really good identifier for me of how that person was geared. And sometimes it was a product of the culture they were in, but how that person was geared. Do they see their job as doing like research? Almost like university, like bench research, or are they more translational in terms of, great, I'm going to do some research, but now I want to bring that, what real success is bringing that to a point of impact. So when we talk about full stack data science, I think that's more of perhaps the spirit or the ethos of it. I care less about the, do you know how to run packages locally or something? Honestly, like you shouldn't have to. If you want to use that as a shibboleth of like technical legitimacy, fine. Like I find that to be somewhat tiresome, but the real thing I care about is when we talk about full stack is, are you able to get your work into prod? And I think in a lot of places, that's what they really mean. It's like a full stack data scientist is also able to think about and build like a UI or an interface. And so at Stitch Fix, I know there were a number of data scientists for a long time that would like, or their algos engineers, whatever they were called, who were able to build React front ends, which is great. But that's another thing that I would say is a real data scientist like able to reason about React?
Yeah.
No, and in fact, Hex, one of the magic things of Hex is that you can take your work and wire a UI up to it and publish an interactive data app without writing a single line of front-end code.
Yeah.
We'll take care of that for you, and we'll take care of the packages stuff for you, and we'll help you focus on the work you want to do. Ideally, we actually make it easier than ever. We make it 10x easier to be a full-stack data scientist because you don't have to know which Python I've got installed locally. And you don't have to know how to use React.
Yeah.
You can focus on the thing you want to be great at and publish it in a way that's going to be really impactful. We can take care of a lot of that. Or we can abstract a lot of that away for you. That's, I think, the ethos of what we're going after. So that's,
yeah. Yeah, I think I observed there are a few type of data scientists. There are data scientists, I would do whatever to get a job done. If you need me to write a React app or learn some other HTML, whatever, they will get the job done. And they enjoy the building part of it. And there's also a lot of data scientists like me. I studied statistics in grad school, and I like to build models. I like to understand the numbers. I don't want to build a React app.
Yeah,
does it mean...
And do you want someone telling you, oh, to be a real data scientist, you need to learn how to run React? And or like, you have to understand how to deploy things to Kubernetes and AWS. No, fuck no. No one wants to do that. Or if you want to do it because you're nerdy and you're excited to learn it, God bless. Mm-hmm. But I don't... Like, you don't want to be told that you have to do that. You want to be focused on the stuff you want to be great at.
So I think it's great that Hex has capacity to empower data scientists to do this. And my take about full stack data science is more about what you mentioned, overseeing the process. Not, oh, I deliver this project to my downstream engineering team and I'm done. I think it's data science job to continue to monitor that, because sometimes if a model doesn't work in production, you need to help the engineers and also measure the impact. Have you helped decision makers make better decisions. Yeah. So later on, you can get a feedback and then build better models or ask better questions.
It's slightly unpopular and controversial even within Hex, but I have a sense sometimes that the best data practitioners don't think of themselves as on the data team. Mm-hmm. They think of themselves as like working with a functional team. And if you're like, let's call it on the more technical end of data science, or I find data science sometimes to be a really imprecise term. What do we mean when we talk about data science? Some people it's like machine learning engineer. Mm-hmm. Some people it's like data analyst who can write a little bit of pandas. It's like it's, so, but well, just let's say in general, but you know, if you're talking about like a machine learning engineer, when you're talking about like working with engineers to get into prod, I think the best folks in those roles think of themselves as on that engineering team. Like you're not on the data team. You might be on like the fraud team. And the best data practitioners, even just an analyst, I think the best ones really think of themselves as I'm on the marketing team because I'm like here to support marketing and help make better marketing decisions. And the converse of that is data teams who really are like, oh, we're in the data team. We do our own planning. We have our own little insular world. We have our own priorities. We all sit together. That I think can perpetuate this ivory towerism and that lack of, let's call it full stackism or like end to end, even just actually a much simpler term is impact.
Yeah.
Like ROI. Like are you delivering real impact for the business? It's, I would posit it is much more likely you are if you are like deeply embedded with the business than if you are like in your own little.
Yeah. I think data scientists should be more embedded in the whatever business function you're supporting. Although our titles are data scientist or machine learning engineer, but I think we're actually business advisors. You see a lot of things the product managers, the engineers don't see. So instead of just passively taking questions from them, you should tell them what to do or at least facilitate the decision making.
Like data maximal, we should really be in charge. Yeah, get out of the way, idiots. No, but there's a common trope that like is just an evergreen thing that keeps coming up of like how data teams measure ROI.
Yeah.
And it always comes around this time of year because it's like annual planning. Mm-hmm. And it's the CFO's, I put in a headcount request and the CFO's asking me if I can measure the ROI of my data team.
Yeah.
And everyone being data nerds, everyone's like, well, I'm going to go calculate the ROI. We worked on this one project and it had 10% left on this thing. I think that's a folly. Mm. I think the way to really measure the ROI of a data team is basically like NPS of your stakeholders. And NPS is net promoter score. It's really just some jargon for like in the consumer world, it's are your customers likely to recommend your product? Right?
Yeah.
It's basically just sentiment. I think instead of trying to sharpen your pencil and do some whole financial model of the ROI of your data team, a much simpler way to think about it is if the CFO went and asked the marketing leader, the CMO, like the marketing leader, the head of sales or whatever, could you live without the data team? And they said, yes, you should not deserve to have a data team. And if they said, no, I can't live without them. And in fact, we've got a backlog of stuff we wish they were able to help us work on. There's your ROI. And it's not precise. It's hard to put a dollar amount to that. But the best person to advocate for headcount for a data team is not the data, like head of data. It's the stakeholders. Like they should be like giving up their own headcount to want more data help.
Yeah.
And I think that comes back to this question of is your data team sort of facing the business? Are they oriented on impact? Do they have the tools? And I'm a tool vendor, so part of me wants to be like, the number one answer is buy a lot of Hex licenses. There's a lot of other things that go into it. Mm. Your Hex licenses won't be as useful if these other things aren't existent. But do you have the tools, and I think Hex can be helpful for this, to have that work feel impactful and useful? There's your ROI. That's, I think, a much more useful way to think about it than trying to, I don't know, have some model for it, even though data people love those models.
Yeah, so I think there's a quantitative way to measure the downstream impact. I think this is maybe a qualitative way to measure it. And
but practically, qualitative can be a dirty term. I don't think it should. I think this is a perfectly legitimate way to think about it.
Why is the dirty term, you think?
Well, amongst data people, qualitative, we're quantitative people. The quantitative stuff is always, I think, viewed as more rigorous, perhaps. Qualitative is squishier, less objective.
Yeah.
And that's true. I mean, certainly in certain domains, but I'm our sort of head of product at Hex. And I think about this within the product management domain. A lot of people want to make product management very objective, very quantitative. Oh, we had this many customer requests for this feature, and it has more than this other feature, and well, the impact to effort ratio is higher for this one, so we should build it. I don't know. Like, I'm the CEO of a data company, and even I would say in that case, like, it's data can be useful.
Yeah.
Like, you can look at data, are people using this feature? Mm-hmm. Or there is a quantitative thing of like, are we getting a lot of requests or no requests for this thing that's useful? But it, like, qualitative taste matters.
Yeah.
Having an opinion, having something you feel in your bones matters. And if that can be informed and reinforced and pointed in the right direction with data, great. But I think we've over-algoed or over-optimized in some places. I think there's companies we can talk about that are sort of very famously very like data-driven and algos-driven and very data science-driven.
Yeah.
That I think you can take it too far. And I think you can reduce everything. The famous story from Google of them like A-B testing different
like
shades of blue.
Like 50 shades of blue.
Or Brian Chesky from Airbnb has been talking about this recently where he's, well, we should be doing less A-B tests because if you do an A-B test and you don't have, well, I don't know if he specifically said less A-B tests, but I think his point was like, a lot of A-B tests, you do them, you don't really have a hypothesis and you get a result and then you're beholden to that result forever. And that can sometimes be used as a crutch or a proxy for product taste and product intuition and soul.
Yeah.
To use a kind of grandiose term. And I feel that very strongly. And so I think data, and again, maybe this is counterintuitive or counterproductive because I should be out telling everyone you should be using data for everything and you should buy hex licenses for everyone. But I'll be the first to say there's a lot of places where data is a poor substitute or should be at very least paired with intuition, I think, and qualitative. So I think qualitative is not a dirty term, even though it feels squishier.
Yeah. As a data scientist, I think if I was early in my career, I would disagree with you. But when I start to work more, I actually realized, so I used to work on the central team of A-B testing platform when I was at Amazon. So we're constantly trying to figure out what is our role? Are we policing other teams to tell them, hey, you have to rely on those metrics and experimentation, or should we facilitate product manager to make decisions, even if those experiments sometimes are inconclusive? I think A-B testing is great if you know what you are optimizing for, like the 50 shades of gray. You know, sorry,
of blue, yeah. I don't know what you guys were optimizing. That sounds like an interesting project. Yeah.
I think the paper said 50 shades of blue. Like that. Yeah. What I was going to say, I was getting somewhere.
Yeah, you were A-B testing everything.
Yeah, you were A-B testing you when you know where you want to get to a local optimum or minimum, but say A-B test is not going to help you figure out the next iPhone or the next ChatGPT.
I think it's a great point. If you know that you're just trying to hill climb, great. Or hill descend, I don't know, gradient descent.
Right? Yeah.
But great, that's wonderful. Those can be worthy things to do. And at Hex, by the way, especially on a lot of the AI stuff, experimentation and A-B testing and all that is really useful. It's good to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, and Amazon is a good example of a company. I love Amazon. I'm an Amazon customer professionally and personally. Shout out to Amazon. But don't turn off our AWS account for me saying this. But I would say Amazon in total is not thought of, I think it's fair to say, as a company with that is led by product taste. Now, I do think they have a really great qualitative orientation around like customer obsession. But you cannot look at the AWS console and tell me this is built by a sense of like product soul and taste.
Yeah.
They're optimizing for different things, but that is an example of a company that I think is very ruled by algos in a way that clearly, look, who am I to criticize Amazon? They built amazing business, but you don't get a sense of product delight and soul coming through the screen when you're using an AWS product necessarily.
Yeah. And I also think once you have figured out the momentum of your intuition, I think later on you can set up experimentation to test, oh, whether this idea is good enough, or use causal inference metrics to test it. But yeah, sometimes I kind of hold two opinions. I think data is definitely informative, is important, but also we shouldn't relying on data 100% because data is only a abstract form of information of what's going on in the world. How do you measure customer happiness or delight from a piece of data, how they click on things?
And this comes back to the first thing we talked about with AI.
Yeah.
Can you get a GPT model to write syntactically correct SQL? Yes. Can you bully it into writing the specific SQL you want, given enough prompt engineering? Yes, we've done that quite well. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that a GPT model is able to replace the intuition and insight that a human can bring to bear. No. And there's these emergent reasoning you see with larger models, and it is cool to see. But I don't know that extrapolates to, again, I don't think it extrapolates to replacing the humans. And this conversation we're having is a really good example. I think a good great data scientist and a great data analyst know where quantitative and qualitative data, they know where a great contextual understanding and business insight and communication and partnership, all how that all mixes into being effective. And maybe I'll be wrong. Maybe GPT-6 or 7 will just be so good and it'll fully replace humans on all these tasks. And maybe it's wishful thinking. Maybe I just don't want to live in that world. But something makes me very skeptical that this appreciation of where data can be most useful, or where you actually need this sort of insight and intuition and soul, it's clearly not evident that the current models can just replace that element of it. And if you think of data science as all this is just writing some code, then you'd misunderstand, I think, what good data scientists do.
Yeah. Actually, it reminds me of a quote, I think from Jeff Bezos. He said, if a customer anecdote tells a different story from the data, he will always believe in the customer anecdote.
Right. I don't know. Maybe the AI maximalists out there will be like, well, great, I'll program a GPT model with the prompt. The prompt will say, you are guided by this Jeff Bezos quote. If you've collected customer anecdotes, and maybe we'll just do enough prompt engineering and enough RAG and enough context and enough fine tuning that these models can emulate that. But I don't know.
But how does this prompt interact with the product managers, interact with the marketing managers or sales?
I guess we'll find out.
Yeah. Maybe that's when we have AGI.
We can all retire.
And
in the meantime, at Hex, we are building products that hopefully help our users. And I think every day I know help our users because I have a lot of customer anecdotes. Mm. Help our users interpret data and connect it to what the decisions that are trying to be made. And the AI features can accelerate that. They can deepen that. They can broaden access to that. But they're not going to replace that human element. And that's the line we're gonna keep pushing on.
Yeah. And now with a lot of data collaboration tools, AI tools, what do you think a CEO should think about when they try to hire their first data team?
Oh. Well, when we made our first data hires, we're a little weird because we're sort of a data company and data nerds ourselves. When we started hiring our data team, we were looking for people who I think were pretty versatile. The first data hire is hard, and it's hard to hire, but it's also hard to be that person because you're having to come in and kind of build the plane while you're flying it because you have to set up. You're likely walking into some amount of debt and perhaps debt from even well-intentioned or partially knowledgeable people like me, but we've got a data warehouse. We've got some stuff dumping into there. There's going to be a good amount of cleanup you're going to have to do. And you have to balance that debt pay down, building new infrastructure with actually trying to be productive for the business. If you spend the first six months, people are like, I'm just trying to get everything set up. Mm-hmm. Everyone's going to be like, why did we hire this person? We're not feeling any impact.
Yeah.
But if you spend the first 6 months just trying to like quick answer one-off QQs, you're not going to have infrastructure that's going to compound. And so you really need someone, I think, who's seen that before and can balance that. And like anyone at an early startup, if you're hiring a first anything, you need people who are pretty flexible and able to roll with the punches and a little bit of chaos. I do think that it's happened as things do step by step, but if I compare what it would be like setting up a data stack today, or even when we were setting our data stack up a couple of years ago, to what it would have been like 10 years ago, it is remarkably different. I mean, I like for organizations large and small, but as a startup, if 10 years ago I had been like, great, here's what I want you to do. I want you to set up a data warehouse. Mm. I want you to have live feeds from a bunch of SaaS tools. I want this data to be refreshed on a tight cadence. You want to have checks and rules, and you want to have pipelines that are written and managed as code.
Yeah.
And that infrastructure, you'd be like, well, shit, I'm going to need a team of 3 data engineers to do that because it's going to be a lot of custom stuff. Today, that's not an overnight thing, but it's also, you can get pretty far in that quarter with one person. Fivetran exists and other ETL tools exist. Modern cloud data warehouses exist. DBT exists. There's a lot of things out there. And AI can be a helpful accelerant for this. Writing SQL, getting tricky syntax, right, is much simpler now than it used to be. And so that acceleration has been great. I think you need a lot more leverage out of much fewer people in terms of setting that infrastructure up just because the tools have gotten better. But that doesn't mean you need less people. That means those people can then move on to do more interesting and more productive things. You can actually use that data to go start having impact much faster. And when we set up our data stack here, that was great. Like our data team was able to get to a very productive place much faster than they would have been able to 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think you mentioned flexibility. That's definitely an important trait because there are some debates about getting their first data team hire. It could be a data engineer that also understands analytics and machine learning, or other people argue, yeah, you do need data engineers to help you set up the database, the pipeline. But if this data engineer doesn't know what kind of downstream problem you're going to solve, then the schema is not going to be built, or the features they collected is not going to be built for machine learning engineer work. So maybe you need to hire a data scientist who knows data engineering and help you build a pipeline.
It depends. I mean, if you're building something that is predicated on a lot of like complex machine learning from day one, you may need a different set of skills.
Yeah.
I would say for most companies, sort of your generic SaaS company, your generic B2C company, your generic whatever company, I think a first hire is an analytics engineer is a sharp thing. And analytics engineering is a bit of a newer term. It's kind of popularized by the GPT community, originally coined by Claire Carroll, who's now a product manager at Hex, incidentally. But by analytics engineer, I mean someone who can reason about what the business is going to need to ask and answer, and then go and has a dexterity and familiarity with the modern data stack such that they can set up those elements and get that stuff up and running. That's usually, I think, the best hire. Yeah, if you have like really complex downstream ML needs, you may need something else. But I think getting that person in place, an analytics engineer in place early, is usually the highest leverage I've seen.
Yeah. And today, a lot of people talk about modern data stack, and different people have different definition. So what are some tools you think that are emerging, and what are some tools you think are like going away?
Oh, good question. No, I had this conversation with someone recently, an investor, who was asking me about what the most exciting things happening in data right now.
Yeah.
And I had to take a beat because we really had a Cambrian explosion a few years ago that Pex was part of. We were a product of that, of new data tools. I think you saw cloud data warehouses emerge, Snowflake, BigQuery, Redshift. And then you saw like the attendant sort of like lower level ETL tools. So Fivetran, DBT, that sort of had this compounding effect of, great, these cloud data warehouses are fast and flexible. It's now even faster and more flexible to get data into them and transform the data there. And then this sort of Cambrian explosion of tools downstream. And a funny thing is I don't know that there's a lot of greenfield left sort of just around that right now. Mm. A lot of the core problems have a bunch of companies already working on them.
Yeah.
And I think a bunch of people felt and hoped, and time will tell, that sort of Gen AI will be a next set of these things. But certainly at Hex, we feel that the problems are the same. The solutions are going to be similar. Gen AI can accelerate, but it doesn't like fundamentally change. I do think that there's some really interesting things where there's companies that were really founded around the sort of like MDS, I want to build a data pipeline for analytics stuff, that have kind of found themselves in the right place at the right time, because a lot of those workflows are really similar to the types of data pipelining you need to do for machine learning and Gen AI. So like Dagster is a great example. I think DBT is also in this camp. I think they're more competitive over time now. But of companies that, like, if your core competency as a product is helping you take a bunch of data, transform it, clean it, turn it into reliable, monitorable pipelines that are useful downstream.
Yeah.
Turns out that's really useful for analytics. It turns out that's also really useful for like Gen AI stuff, because for like RAG pipelines, at least up until the RAG pipeline functioning is completely dependent on having the right data cleaned and stored and indexed. And so I think there's something really interesting there, the convergence of these things. I think, and in fact, it's interesting that the infrastructure for machine learning and analytics had sort of been pretty separate for a while. And I think at the infrastructure level, that will come together more.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting. There's kind of this trope of the modern data stack is dead. I don't think the modern data stack is dead. I think the modern data stack like won. Like no one talks about it anymore because it's just the thing. Mm. Like we talk to Fortune 500 company's customers and they're like, yeah, we got Snowflake. We're bringing in these tools. Like to them, it's not, they're on the like last wave of adoption and they're doing it. It's, so I think the modern data stack is dead in terms of being like a new pithy marketing slogan for startups. Sure. Yeah. I just think it's the new reality. It just is the data stack now.
I think a lot of time data scientists feel we already have a lot of tools. I don't want to adopt a new tool. So when you talk to your customers, what kind of feedback do they give you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of that. And especially the last couple of years is in the first approximation, Hex actually helps consolidate a good amount of things. So yeah. It's likely that folks actually have a bunch of tools floating around that are sort of point solutions. So you've got a SQL query runner over here and a Jupyter notebook thing over here and something to publish a data app over here. And I've got a bunch of scripts coming together. And so Hex can actually simplify a lot of that. I mean, notebooks, Jupyter notebooks are free. So at some level, like, you know, there's extra cost, but you are simplifying the amount of things floating around and can streamline a lot of that. We also have a lot of customers who start to replace their reporting and BI tools with Hex. Now, we didn't found Hex to be a BI tool. I think there's a lot of reasons to say that. But if a lot of the core tasks that people try to do with BI, like I want to go pull some data, turn it into a presentable interactive experience that I can share with stakeholders, Hex is actually really great at and can do things no BI tool can do. So the biggest version of Hex and the thing that I'm really interested in is sort of building this unified front end for the data stack. And I don't mean that every other front end goes away, like we're going to be the front end to Fivetran and to I don't mean that. But I kind of mean this like shared window to the data assets at your organization. Like, can we be the place where everyone comes together to ask and answer questions, to work with data, to share their results? And I think the net result of that will actually be like less tools. Again, I don't mean that Hex is one tool to rule them all and get rid of everything else. But at very least, I think it means a simpler set of workflows and a more efficient set of workflows. And I think there's a lot of ROI in that for teams and for organizations. Most SaaS CEOs won't talk about this, or I don't know if they will or won't, but I don't mind. Every single SaaS company that I'm aware of saw in the last year and a half contraction. Some saw a lot of churn. All of them saw contraction. And you know this for a fact because every public company that has to report on the results does. And all the private companies that I'm aware of, including us, did. We saw a seat contraction. But what we didn't see was account churn. And that to me says something really important, which is our product is seen as indispensable. Now, we had customers that did layoffs. So yeah, you're going to lose some seats there. But it's clear to me that our product has really become sort of like an indispensable piece of infrastructure, more or less, at a lot of our customers. Most of our customers, almost all of our customers, we basically have no account churn. And that, among a lot of other data points, is evidence to me that we're not at our customers, not just like another tool floating around, but we're something that has really become indispensable for their workflow.
I think I also observed the same trend. I also have seen some data tools. They don't even have free accounts available anymore. And I think Hex, for example, when I tried it, I go to hex.tech and I can create a free account. I can access a lot of features. Yeah. Do you plan to keep this available for a while?
Yeah, we've got a lot of people who use we call it our community tier. A lot of people who use it, and that's great. If you're an individual, you're a student, you're a hobbyist, you have about a 0% chance to pay us anyway. Like individuals don't pay for software. That's the thing a lot of people miss in SaaS. Like, I know we'll have a tier for individuals that they can pay us, and it doesn't work. There's no company that very few companies, there's some weird exceptions, but very few companies that I'm aware of that have succeeded on like individuals paying for something for personal use. And so you might as well give it away to those people. And then of course, the question is always how you package the tiers such that when you start using it professionally, and which is of course an indicator that you probably have some budget and willingness to pay, that we're encouraging you into the pro tier that's going to better fit your needs. And you can look at that as like carrot or stick, like we're going to beat people into it. I like to think of it more as we're going to provide a bunch of great features at that tier that as you're starting to work with a team are going to feel indispensable. So yeah, I don't mind giving it away to the free tier. I mean, it costs us some to operate. Compute's not cheap, but it's also, I don't know, even just like the ethos of there's all these people out there that have about a 0% chance of being willing to or able to pay us, but they benefit a lot from our software. I don't know. I'm happy to underwrite that.
Yeah, that's awesome. So previously we talked about like Gen AI. So has Hex used any generative AI or large language models embedded into the workflow in a notebook?
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. So Last year, we introduced our set of magic features. So mm-hmm. we introduced what I think are like fairly obvious things. We were the first, I believe the first to do it, but fairly obvious things around. You can type a prompt and it will write some SQL or write some code for you. Type a prompt and we'll edit a query for you. We'll have magic fix. We had magic explain. So a bunch of really nice features and utilities for that. In the time since, we've introduced a bunch of other capabilities. So we have magic charts now. So you can type a prompt and get a visualization.
Yeah.
And we'll edit a visualization for you. And so there's a bunch of really nice things we've been able to do that really improve the workflow. There's a feature that's now in private beta called Magic Analysis, where you can type a prompt and we'll write a whole series of cells for you, which is really neat. Under the hood, there's a ton that goes into doing that well and doing it accurately. And in data, I think especially having the right context, being able to give it the right metadata, writing an accurate query, there's a lot of depth and nuance to doing that well. Our team has done a great job with it. We see really impressive results on that front. What interests me from a UX perspective is there's a lot of chat products out there, right?
Yeah.
Like ChatGPT, of course, but even within data, there's some people who are like AI for BI chatbot. I think chat's all well and good. If you kind of break down what do people like about chat, is it the conversational nature of it? I think there's a nice like iterative thing of I can type a prompt and get something. I think a notebook is actually a really similar, it's got a lot of actually like similar properties. If you think about like a really great notebook that like a data scientist or data analyst might share with you, it's going to have a mix of like text and the code and outputs. It'll have nice explanations and almost maybe even feel a little conversational. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things we're doing with the UX for our Magic Analysis product is kind of bringing the best of chat to the notebook UI, which we think is much more functional. No one wants to share a chat.
Yeah.
But you can share the ChatGPT chats. And I think that's neat, kind of as a little bit of a show your work or like a search result thing. But if you were like a data scientist wanting to build something to share with a stakeholder, you're not going to want to share like an 80 message chat that's sorry, try that again or whatever. Like what you want to share is sort of like the cleaned up result. And we want to bring that sort of prompt driven editing workflow of chat into a really functional UI, which it turns out we've already built what I think is the best. We think the cell paradigm is actually really profound in this context because we can generate chains of them, including some text in between. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited about where that can go. So I'm bearish on chat as the end all be all UI, especially for data work.
Yeah.
But I think we're going to be, well, we are building and I use it and soon the whole world will be able to use it. This sort of bringing the best of chat into a really nice user experience for data is something we're really interested in.
Yeah. That's very exciting. Do you think in the future, when data scientists handed a report and then the stakeholder can just ask questions in a chat interface, or it's more for data scientists to answer a stakeholder's question, they can quickly get an answer from their work?
Both. I mean, I think the latter first. I think these Gen AI models are great. They also hallucinate and they also... There's a lot of work that is going to be required, I think, to get to a point where you can feel comfortable unleashing it on like the business users, the stakeholders. I do think there's some interesting things where you can imagine sharing something with someone and then, as you said, like typing a prompt and maybe seeing something jump off from
that.
That's great. I think I have a fundamental disagreement maybe with some other folks out there where I think certainly in the short term, I don't think the next step is just set all the business users loose with like data chatbots. I think it's the wrong answer for a lot of reasons. And I know why people want it to be the right answer.
Yeah.
Because it's like a shortcut. It's, oh, like, cool. Gen AI, neat. You can like prompt engineer enough to write some reasonable SQL. Neat. What if this was the new UI for how people worked? Well, what these people are finding is that one of the things you want to do pretty soon is, well, I want to be able to edit a chart. Well, now you need a chart editor. Well, I got this result and I want to be able to like tweak some of the SQL or experiment with a different way to do it. Do you want to be doing that all via prompt? Well, no, it's actually, you want to be able to have mousing and keyboarding in places. And I think actually like a multimodal, to bastardize a term slightly, experience. And so unfortunately, some of these companies that I think started as like AI for BI chatbots are sort of realizing they're going to have to build everything that goes into building like a full-featured data product.
Yeah.
And some of them will get there. But I think that there's a synthesis. There's like a thesis and a synthesis that's going to emerge here of how AI actually comes into our workflows.
Yeah.
I don't think it's everything becomes a chatbot. It just isn't.
Mm-hmm. And for data scientists to prepare the future of their career, what do you think they should focus on right now? What are something you think it's overhyped, a lot of noise, what is underhyped?
Well, I think a few years ago, the answer was like, if you want to be a data scientist, go learn Python.
Yeah.
And I don't think that everyone should let their technical skills wither or evaporate. At the same time, I think that the biggest factor to success for data scientists will stop being, and it never really was, but it certainly won't be like knowledge of the pandas API syntax. So I think that really, actually, the best data practitioners, it's not like different than it ever was to me. I don't think it is. In that it's like the best data practitioners should be the ones who like really seek to understand how the business works.
Yeah.
They should be thinking about how they communicate. They should be thinking about and focusing on and trying to learn how to partner with stakeholders to understand problems and drive better decisions. Like,
yeah.
Those are all the skills that I think have always been important. And I think, well, maybe what will really happen is that a lot of what felt important in terms of like deep knowledge of the pandas syntax will just be melted and stripped away. And that part of that sort of real heart of what made a great data practitioner will just become more and more the whole thing. So that's what I would recommend people earlier in their career really internalize. That's the job. It's not writing code, because there's things that are going to do a pretty good job writing code. The question is, do you know which code to ask it to write?
Yeah.
That's the hard part.
And what do you think about the future of data science?
It's bright. I mean, so again, going back to something I said earlier, I think data science is a pretty broad term.
Yeah.
And if we split it into what I think over the last 10 years got sort of intertwined, there's machine learning engineering, very bright. I think there is certainly areas where it's going to be deeper than ever. There's areas where in some ways, I don't mean this pejoratively, but I think it'll be shallower. Like, I think ML engineering is going to be less like, I know how to train a large neural net from scratch.
Yeah.
And some more maybe of, I know how to take a foundation model and do some basic fine tuning or prompt engineering to get it to do the thing. The other half of data science, or I think it's actually more than half of data science, is really analytics. That's also bright. And going back to what I said earlier, I think there's a boundless demand for insight. And I think AI will only help us accelerate and tap into that more. And that's what, I think there's going to be more demand for that forever. So I'm very bullish.
Yeah. And what is something you feel excited about in this year? Could be your career or personal life.
Well, I've talked about a bunch of the stuff I'm excited about. Product-wise, when you're building a company, you're building a product, but you're also building a lot of other things. You're building a culture and a team, and I'm very proud of that, and I'm excited to see that continue to grow and change. We brought some wonderful people in recently, and we're speaking on January 4th, I think, right at the beginning of the year, and I've never been more excited for what's ahead of us on all of those facets.
Yeah.
Personally, we just had our first kid 7 months ago, so I'm also very excited for that aspect. Yeah. Continuing to be on that journey is something I'm really excited about. I think it's going to be a fun year.
Yeah. What are some new features you're going to launch in Hex?
Well, we talked about some of the AI stuff. We talked about some stuff we're really interested in around workflow and governance and lifecycle. There's some really neat stuff we're working on that I will not talk about because I want it to be a surprise for everyone. Yeah. I think I'm very interested in how do we accelerate and deepen the workflows for our current users, the people who are currently sort of in the addressable user base and fan base for Hex. But how do we take these capabilities of inquiry and working with data and bring them out to more and more people over time? And so there's a lot we're thinking about working on there. And there's even stuff much lower level. There's some really cool stuff we're doing with our compute engine. There's some really cool stuff we're doing with like scalability. This stuff you don't go out and like market necessarily, but I've never been more proud of our team and more excited about all the things we're working on. And it's a fun thing when you feel like a lot of the things you're working on also are compounding and coming together in a really profound way.
So for folks who want to follow along your journey or try Hex, where can they find you?
So our website is hex.tech, and folks listening to the show can sign up for a extended free trial of our team steer, which has a lot of fun bells and whistles. So that's hex.tech/DS show. And if you hit that link, you can get an extended free trial.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And then our Twitter, if you search for us on Twitter, Hex or Hex Tech will pop up. And then my Twitter is Barald, B-A-R-A-L-D, which was my middle school nickname, but you can probably just search my name and I'll pop up. But yeah, we'd love to have folks try the product, follow along. If you sign up, you'll get our future release emails. We're building a bunch of cool stuff, so you can follow along with that. And if you have any feedback, questions, thoughts, feel free to reach out to me. I love hearing from people who are trying the product. So yeah.
Awesome. Go to hex.tech/DS show and then let us know what you think.
And make sure to like and subscribe. We can't forget about that.
Five-star reviews.
Yeah, 5-star reviews. Like, subscribe, 5 stars. Share with all your friends. I'll do your plug too.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Barry.
Thanks for having me on. This was fun. Thanks for listening.